We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes, it's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I got a bad feeling about this.
You see, we're on a mission from God.
Why didn't I take the blue pill?
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Tackling life's most important questions. This is the Don Johnson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Don Johnson Show. Great to have you along today on Immaculate Heart Radio. I have a very special treat for you this segment. Carlo Broussard is here. He's one of the most dynamic and gifted Catholic minds in the country, in my opinion. A full-time speaker and apologist for Catholic Answers. You hear him often on Catholic Answers Live, of course. And he is the author of dozens of articles and booklets, including one on miracles in the 20 Answers series just released from Catholic Answers Press. Carlo Broussard, welcome to the Don Johnson Show.
Hey, thanks. Great to be on with you, my friend.
Now, before we get to your wonderful booklet, I really enjoyed this booklet on miracles, Carlo. Before we get to that, tell me a little bit about the series of which it is a part and the 20 Answers Challenge that Catholic Answers has put forth for us for Lent and Easter this year.
Yeah, well, we have 20 Answers booklets, right? So 20 booklets on different topics of the Catholic faith within apologetics. You have 20 questions and 20 succinct, short answers, anywhere from 750 words to 1,000 words, roughly speaking, from various different authors, myself, my colleague and friend Trent Horn, Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin. We even have some from Matt Fratt, etc. And the 20 Answers Challenge is that we are challenging folks to buy the whole package, all 20 booklets of the 20 Answers booklets, and we're challenging them to read the booklets during all 20 during the Lenten and Easter season. So that's the challenge. But what's beautiful, Don, is that we're knocking the price down to half price for all 20 booklets, and then we're going to take $10 of that and give it to St. Paul Street Evangelization so that they can have these booklets, get some of these booklets and share these booklets in their ministry as they're sitting in the parks and sitting on the sidewalks and the highways and the byways, sharing the Catholic faith with people who walk by. So we're partnering up and teaming up with St. Paul Street Evangelization so that we can get these booklets in people's hands so that they can see and learn the answers to these questions and hopefully enlighten some minds and move some hearts to come into the fullness of truth and life in the Catholic faith.
Yeah, it's I love it. It's an amazing opportunity. I'm ahead of the challenge here, Carlo. I've been working through a few of the books. I talked to Trent last week on the show, and he's got several books in it, and your book on miracles here before this show, and we've got Jim Blackburn coming up later. Later in today. So it is a really great opportunity and half price, and you're helping out St. Paul Street Evangelization. So an amazing opportunity. Go to catholic.com and go to the shop there to take part. Now, this miracles book, I'm so excited that this was a part of it, Carlo. Personally, I think miracles and their role in drawing people to Jesus is somewhat underrated in evangelization circles. I don't know, maybe that's just me, but I find that they're there, and I find that personally people often base their own faith largely on some sort of supernatural experience. Like there's a lot of them out there, but we don't talk about them that much in the culture. Is that your impression as well? Like it's there, but it's underplayed. We don't want to look foolish or something. What do you think?
That is correct, Don. It is there, and it's sort of the secret weapon that hasn't been taken out in the battle yet. You know, it's sort of that sleeping giant. The miracles are a fabulous gift that we have, both in the apostolic age and the historicity of the miracles of Jesus and the apostles, but also the miracles that have been wrought by God in the history of our Catholic Christian faith. And these miracles can serve as a very effective tool in evangelization. You know, we can go through all of the philosophical arguments of God's existence and the historicity of Jesus, etc. But many times, it's just sharing a miraculous event that has occurred in Catholic history, wrought by some through the intercessory prayer of some saint, whether the saint was on earth or in heaven, whatever have you. And very often that miraculous effect can move the heart and at least awaken the mind to begin pursuing the idea of the transcendent. And is the transcendent real, namely God and the Jesus question? So if a miracle doesn't in fact convert somebody and lead them to the faith immediately, it at least gets them started on the quest for the truth about God, Jesus, and the Catholic Church. So it definitely serves a purpose in evangelization that many have not capitalized on. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the booklet, to share with people the beauty of miracles and the gift of miracles, teach them how to respond to some of the objections from a philosophical point of view, share with them some examples of miracles, Eucharistic miracles, the incorruptibles, healing miracles in our Catholic history, and try to provide Catholics with a proper perspective that we want to take when we approach miracles. We want to have a healthy skepticism, but at the same time, we don't want to ignore them. Because if miracles were good enough for Jesus, Don, remember, Jesus said, if you don't believe my words that I'm sent from the Father, believe my works. So if miracles were good enough for Jesus, well, then they sure are good enough for us as well.
Yeah, well, that's a great point, Carlo. I mean, the ministry of Jesus is largely predicated on the fact that he's doing the miracles, right? And you see the apostles go out, and their argument is, we saw the miracles, here's the evidence, therefore believe. It's not like they were asking people to sort of just, you know, believe blindly or something like that. So that's a great point.
That's right. Yeah, you bring up a great point here, Don, because as the Catechism states in paragraph 156, our act of faith is not a blind impulse of the mind, but God has given us motives of credibility. And the Catechism is drawing from the First Vatican Council, when the First Vatican Council defined the very purpose of miracles, namely the authentication of divine revelation, that these are most certain signs of God's revelation, which makes our act of faith reasonable as opposed to a blind impulse of the mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you brought up before that we should have a healthy skepticism, and this is something I really appreciate about the Catholic Church, frankly, is that as a convert, as I approached the church, I realized that the Catholic Church actually has a very strong skepticism towards miracle claims. And this is something that maybe the culture doesn't appreciate. They think that, oh yeah, somebody says something, you know, this happened here and we just have to accept it. No, that's not how the church approaches it, is it? I mean, they're analyzing and investigating these things pretty strongly.
Yeah, this is true. And you know, Don, I think a case in point, an example par excellence of this, is with regard to the miracles at Lourdes and Lourdes, France. You know, from what I understand, there are allegedly 60,000 reported miracles at Lourdes, right? Allegedly. But the church and the committee that the church has to investigate these claims, only 69 have been approved as official miracles that have taken place at Lourdes. So out of 60,000, only 69 have been seen as legitimate. That testifies to the church's reservation and this healthy skepticism as she approaches the miraculous claims and investigates them. You don't want to go around just believing anybody and any Joe Blow who says, by golly, I saw Mary in a potato chip.
Right.
I mean, we need to have this healthy skepticism. You know, St. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 21, test all things, right, and keep that which is good. And so the church is simply carrying out that instruction of St. Paul to test all things, to test these things. And you know, Don, another reason why the church wants to test these things is because not all wondrous effects are miracles. They could very well be the activity of the demonic, right? So the church is very careful because she wants to distinguish between divine activity, effects wrought by God's causal power, and wondrous deeds that may very well be the effect of demonic activity. So, for example, levitation, right? That's not something that requires divine power. That's an effect that can be brought about by the powers of a created being, namely a spiritual being. So the church wants to test these things and look at the effects, look at the events very carefully and see, is this an event that can be brought about by a created power or a natural cause, or is it something that can only be brought about by divine power, such as the resurrection of the dead, or the giving of new skin when there's no skin there,
right,
or the healing of a limb, or the giving sight, or sight being found in a blind eye, a defective eye. You have a natural effect, sight, there's nothing, I mean, that's natural, but you don't find that natural effect of sight in the defective eye. So whenever you have sight in a blind eye, you know that is attributable to divine power, and no created cause can bring about that effect, because what you have here is a creation ex nihilo. You have being being given from non-being, from nothing, and that requires divine infinite power.
Yeah, that's a good point. And maybe we should go, I mean, your number one question in your booklet is,
yeah,
what is a miracle? That's actually important to define,
right,
because you know, the Mary in the potato chip is not going to cut it, is it? so what
yeah,
what do we consider a miracle?
Yeah, well, as I approach the definition of a miracle from sort of a Thomistic understanding of it, and I think the catechism embodies it. So a miracle, Don, is basically an extraordinary sensible effect wrought by God that surpasses the powers of created nature. Now, that's a mouthful, okay? So let me try to unpack that.
Hold on, I'm going to stop you right there. Can you stick with us for,
yeah,
for a few more minutes here?
We got to go to
a break. I'm hearing the music, so we're going to go to a break, and we're going to continue with Carlo right after this break. You're listening to the Don Johnson Show on Immaculate Heart Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Don Johnson Show. Great to have you along today on Immaculate Heart Radio. We are going to continue our conversation with Carlo Broussard. You know Carlo from Catholic Answers Live and his wonderful blog posts and videos that he makes and all sorts of things. He's also written a wonderful booklet as part of the 20 Answers Challenge, which Catholic Answers is challenging us to do this Lent and Easter season. It's called Miracles, and Carlo is here talking about that. First, Carlo, do you have other booklets in the series as well, or is Miracles the one for you?
Yeah, Miracles is the only one that I have in the series.
All right, well,
so I came on. I've only been with Catholic Answers for a little over a year, so I'm a slow rider, Don, and I'm working on it.
I'm with you, Carlo.
I'm not a writing machine like my colleague and good friend Trit Horn.
Oh, I know.
Books like every week or something.
I know. I've been working on something too. I'm with you, man. I'm like, I don't know how these guys turn out these books so fast, because it takes me a while too. Anyway, we're talking about miracles. And if you just joined us, I encourage you to go and check out the podcast of this particular show, because Carlo has already brought us a ton of great information about miracles. And now we're talking about the definition of a miracle. What is it that make something a miracle? Just seeing, you know, Mary's face in a potato chip doesn't necessarily cut it. So, Carlo, I cut you off before the break, but let's get back into that. What do you consider a miracle?
Yeah, so, for example, one aspect of a miracle, Don, that I was talking about before the break, is that the effect has to be beyond the powers of created nature. And it can be beyond the powers of created nature in several ways. So, first of all, we could look at the effect itself. The case in point here is the glorification of the body, the glorified body, where the body will be glorified, having these gifts of agility and subtlety, passing through walls, traveling from point A to point B at the speed of thought, being incorruptible. That effect cannot be brought about by any created power, the powers of a created being. It requires divine power. Now, here's something interesting. We also can look at the subject in which the effect is produced. Now, that's some highfalutin philosophical language there, so let me explain it. So, for example, take life, Don. Life is natural, right? It's a natural thing. But when you find life in a corpse, well, therein you have a miracle, right? So the effect, which is life, is natural, but it's found in a subject that it ordinarily is not found in, namely a corpse. So when you have a resurrection of the dead, you know that's a miracle. Another example is sight in a blind eye. Sight's a natural thing, But when you find it in the subject of a blind eye, where it ought not be, in ordinarily speaking, when you have a blind person being able to see, well, therein lies a miracle. So, for example, I'm thinking of a Sicilian woman that Padre Pio healed when she was 7 years old. She had no pupils. She couldn't see. Padre Pio healed her. And 7 years later, she still can see to this day, even though her eyes are still defective. She still has no pupils, but yet sight is found in her eyes. She can see. And then finally, Don, a miracle would be beyond the powers of created nature by the mode or the manner. So, for example, bones ordinarily heal over time. But whenever you have bones healing a command through prayer, therein lies a miracle. And finally, rain is natural. But whenever you have rain coming down on command by a prayer, therein lies a miracle. So it's the mode or the manner that can be beyond the powers of created nature. And then finally, a miracle is going to be extraordinary. So, for example, it's not going to ordinarily be a part of the order of nature or grace. So the creation of the universe, the creation of the human soul, God, only God can do these things. But God wills these things as ordinarily a part of the order of nature. Even the infusion of grace in the soul through baptism and the sacraments. This is something only God can do, directly speaking, through the instrumentality of the material things in the sacraments. But yet, he wills that these things are ordinarily a part of the order of grace. So this is basically various aspects of a miracle. And the reason why it's so complex, Don, is because it's beautiful, because it rules out, it precludes wondrous deeds that could be wrought by created beings, powers of created beings, such as spiritual beings. So this is why we need to have a good definition of a miracle, so that we can discern the difference between God acting and whether there's some sort of created spiritual being acting. Right. And we got to test these.
Yeah, that's very helpful, Carlo. Now, I think then we would distinguish, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you would distinguish what you're talking about as a miracle and something that, you know, the church can look to as authoritative. And some of the, what I would call providential movements of God in our lives, that we ascribe to God, and I think rightly so, but maybe we wouldn't call them a miracle in that sense. So, for instance, I need $47.30 to pay my tuition. I don't have it. Somebody shows up, you know, 5 minutes after I pray with exactly that amount in change or something. And would you call that that's not necessarily a miracle then in that sense, but yet still maybe we could ascribe it to God. Is that correct?
That is correct, Don. I mean, you know, in our normal language, we say, oh, it's a miracle. And we're using that term loosely there, but technically speaking, it wouldn't be classified as a miracle per se in order to authenticate God's divine revelation in the apostolic age, or to show that God is directly acting in this particular instance, and the church would identify it as a miracle. We would simply ascribe those events to God's divine providence as he works in our lives, guiding us and leading us through material things, through people, etc. So we would attribute that to God's divine providence, of course, but we wouldn't technically call it a miracle.
Yeah, well, that's very helpful, and I think that shows how seriously the church takes these claims, I think, that we want great clarity on it. Now, talk about, there's several other, I'd love to go through your whole book. We don't have time for that, but some common objections that people might have. I mean, hasn't science ruled out miracles, Carlo? I mean, we're a scientific age.
Yeah.
Hasn't that just, you know, done away with this whole notion? How do we address that?
Right. Yeah, well, very often, you know, this dates all the way back to the 18th century Scottish skeptic philosopher David Hume, where he rejected miracles because he saw miracles as a violation of the laws of nature. You know, the idea is that these laws of nature are solid. They can't be changed. They can't be violated. If you say there's a miracle, well, then we're going to have to give up these laws of nature. We're going to have to give up on science. So many see science and miracles as incompatible. But nothing could be further from the truth, Don, because the laws of nature that we talk about in science, they basically describe the inherent powers of natures. In other words, the laws of nature describe laws of natures. That is to say, they describe what things have, the powers that things have within their very nature. So water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, that tells us it has the power to freeze at that temperature. fire burns. That's the law of nature. That's just simply describing the inherent power to burn. So remember, Don, a miracle is an effect that surpasses the created powers of nature because it is God who is acting. And these miraculous effects in no way violate the laws of these natures and the inherent powers. It's just simply something being done beyond them. So, for example, in the case of a resurrection, you have life being given to a corpse, right? But that doesn't disprove the scientific law of nature that dead people remain dead, right? Yeah. All things equal, when you have a corpse, that corpse is not coming back to life unless God decides to act over and beyond that nature and give life to the corpse. Walking on water, right? That's a wondrous deed, all right? But that doesn't disprove the fact that water ordinarily doesn't have the property to hold people up, right?
Yeah.
You're still going to sink. You go walk out on the water, you're going to sink in the water. So these miraculous effects in no way disprove the laws of nature. Take, for example, the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Don. Remember that in Daniel, I think Daniel chapter 13?
Yeah.
In this case, what we have here is God suspending a power inherent in the nature of fire. Not violating, just suspending it. So God wills that the inherent power of fire would not manifest itself and burn Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But that doesn't disprove the law of nature or violate it, which states fire burns, right? You go put your hand in fire, it's going to burn you. Even though in that particular instance, God suspended that inherent power from manifesting itself. So in no way do these miracles violate the laws of nature because the miraculous effect is an effect that surpasses or goes beyond the created powers of nature. It's not a violation of these powers.
Yeah, that's a very important point. I think Hume has just been one of the most disastrous thinkers in history. He's had
a
terrible effect. Hey,
and every philosopher has to deal with Hume. The philosophy of religion,
yep.
Man, we have to deal with Hume.
Very quickly, Carlo, while I've got you, how would you deal, and I know I'm not going to give you enough time here, Hume's charge that even if those miracles did exist, we should always discount them. It's always the least probable thing, right? Like even if the guy did walk on water,
right.
I can't believe him because most of the time that doesn't happen. Do we have a quick response for that?
Yeah, well, first of all, that's called the repeatability principle. And if that's the case, Don, well, then we will have to reject all testimony of the Big Bang because that's a one-time event that hasn't been repeated.
Right.
We're going to have to reject all the testimony of Neil Armstrong walking on the moon because that's a one-time event that hasn't been repeated. And then furthermore, you know, Hume makes the fundamental mistake of gathering up evidence versus the reliability of the evidence. Just because you have a lot of things that have occurred over and over again, it doesn't negate the fact that if you have good evidence that something unique has occurred, then you're justified in your acceptance of that event.
Great stuff, Carlo. We've been talking with Carlo Broussard. He is the author of many booklets and articles, including one called Miracles, which is in the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers. I encourage you to go take the 20 Answers challenge. It's half price right now, and 10 of those dollars goes to St. Paul Street Evangelization. So go to Catholic.com right now and get your set. Carlo, it's been great to talk to you, man.
It's been great talking with you as well, Don. Thanks a lot, buddy. I appreciate it.
All right, God bless, and we'll be right back on the Don Johnson Show. Stick around. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Don Johnson Show. Great to have you along on Immaculate Heart Radio today. Another great segment. Jim Blackburn is here. He's a Catholic apologist, author, and speaker. He's got a master's degree in theology from John Paul the Great University. He's the author of several articles and books, including one we're going to talk about today, 20 Answers, Divorce, and Remarriage. You've heard him often on Catholic Answers Live. Jim Blackburn, welcome to the Don Johnson Show.
Thank you so much, Don. Great to be here. Really appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Jim, tell us about this 20 Answers Challenge. We've actually talked to Trent Horn already and Carlo about it, but in case people missed, just give us a quick rundown because it's a great program that Catholic Answers is offering for Lent and Easter.
Yes, and in fact, that's exactly what it is. It's a preparation to it's an offer to get something that will take you through Lent. The 20 Answers booklets by Catholic Answers are a series of faith and apologetic related topics. 20 questions on each topic with you know, thorough, detailed answers on the most common questions to these particular topics. And the way this challenge works is Catholic Answers has put together all 20 of the 20 Answers booklets into a package and cut the price in less than half. It would ordinarily be $79 to buy all 20 of them. And Catholic Answers is offering for $34.95 the entire package of 20 booklets. With the idea that, you know, pick these up, have them ready for Lent, and then over the course of Lent, read them all. And, you know, it doesn't take that long. They're 70 pages each, roughly, so it doesn't take long to get through them. But, you know, and if you read just one a day, you could do it halfway through Lent and you'd be done with them. But then in addition to that, for every person who takes this challenge, Catholic Answers is going to be donating $10 worth of products to St. Paul Street Evangelization to help them out in their efforts. So I think this is just great all the way around. Anyone who purchases the package is going to have a great Lenten program to go through on their own. St. Paul Street Evangelization, they're going to have some resources that they can use to further their work. And so it's just a great thing.
Yeah, it really is a fantastic deal. I've got my box of booklets and have been working my way through. They're very easy to read, but they're not light reading. I mean, in the sense that, man, you're getting such great information, but very succinctly. 20 answers, 20 of the most common questions that people might have for each topic. And so, yeah, I highly recommend people take advantage of this. Now, you've got three booklets, I think, three or four in there. One on the papacy, one on scripture and tradition, and one, they gave you the hot button topic, one that we want to talk about first up today, one on divorce and remarriage. Jim, this is a bit of a touchy subject these days.
You know, it's really on a lot of people's minds with, well, Pope Francis's post-synodal exhortation that he released a while back concerning communion for those who are divorced and remarriage. You know, that right now is such a hot topic in the church. And of course, I do cover that topic in 20 Answers, Divorce and Remarriage. But really, I have found in my work as an apologist that the most common topic that Catholics, when they want to talk to an apologist, the most common topic they want to talk about is the church's teaching on marriage, divorce, annulment, remarriage, weddings, these kinds of things. And I figured that out a long time ago, and I've written extensively on it, articles. I've actually got another book I've written on it. But then when it came time to do this 20 Answers on Divorce and Remarriage, I took all of what I thought people were most interested in hearing, Catholics especially, most interested in really knowing about, and I put that into this booklet. And I start with just the idea of what is marriage? I think we've got kind of a situation in our culture right now where a lot of Catholics, unfortunately, get their idea of what marriage is from secular society. And while secular society gets some of it right, it does not get all of it right. And for a Catholic to really understand and see marriage, how God wants us to see marriage, is really important. I think if more Catholics knew what the church really teaches on marriage, there would be many fewer divorces, long-term marriages, and much happier marriages in the long run.
I'm absolutely with you. This is a huge thing. I actually hosted Catholic Answers Live on one of those days where you had the canon lawyer as a guest, and people, yes, almost all of the questions were, tell me if my marriage is valid or how to have a valid marriage and this sort of thing. But I also agree with you that the understanding of marriage is fundamental to so many other of these cultural issues. And correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, but it seems to me that sometimes the religious teachings, whether it's coming from the Catholic Church or some other place, but they tend to see it all as, well, no, no, no. You know, you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do this. When really, the Catholic understanding of marriage is a big positive, isn't it? It's like, this is how to have a blessed life.
It really is. It is an invitation to enter into the really the most fundamental of human relationships. But properly understood, this becomes a relationship that mirrors that of Christ and the Church. You know, I've been married for many years, and I know you have too, Don, and we should be approaching our marriages as Christ approaches his marriage. He's the bridegroom of the Church. You know, he loved the Church and loves the Church so much that he gave his life for the Church, and he is always there offering us forgiveness, you know, when we fall. These kinds of things, when we see how Christ loves the Church, and then we apply that to our marriages and love our spouses in that way, the fruit from that is, it's really sacramental graces that we receive if we're in a sacramental marriage. But then that goes on where our families become what the Church calls domestic churches. So we are Christ to each other, raising a small church, you know, our children together. And this is just a beautiful thing. And it is a very big yes. The no's that we sometimes hear, we hear them because they don't lead us down the right path. Whereas when we're getting married, all the yeses that come with that eventually lead us to heaven, and
right.
We lead each other to heaven because we're Christ to each other in our marriages. So it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get into just one or two of these questions that you cover in the book. I know as a longtime non-Catholic, I'm relatively new to the Catholic Church, as you know, Jim, I didn't dig into it too much, but it always struck me that, well, Catholics don't get divorced, but they get annulments, and that's basically the same thing anyway. And I think the culture sort of has that view, like, oh, annulment is just Catholic divorce. Help us, especially for those non-Catholics we have listening. There is a difference. What's the difference between divorce and annulment within the Catholic view?
Yes. Well, and Don, that's a common confusion. In fact, that's a common phrase. Annulments are just Catholic divorces. Well, it's simply not the case. The Catholic Church really is the one Christian church who continues to hold fast to what Jesus is recorded as saying in Matthew 19:6, that what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. That means that when a couple marry in a Christian marriage and they've consummated that marriage, it's indissoluble by any human interaction at all. Only death dissolves a valid sacramental consummated marriage. So the Catholic Church takes this very seriously. The Church does recognize there may be a deterioration of a relationship to a point where they must separate and even legally or civilly divorce, but that does not end the marriage. But in cases when that happens, oftentimes one or both spouses will say, you know, that didn't work out, and I would love to be able to marry someone else. The Church's first response to that is, well, you're already married. You can't marry someone else. However, we'll look into it. We'll look at what happened on the day you got married. Did a valid marriage come into existence or not? And if the Church determines that a valid marriage did not come into existence on the wedding day, the Church will declare that marriage to have been null. That doesn't mean it wasn't ever a good relationship. It doesn't mean that good did not come from it. Even children may have come from it. And those can be all good things, but the relationship was not a marriage, and therefore the spouses are free then potentially to go on and marry other people. So it's not a divorce. It's simply a recognition of what was thought to be a marriage indeed was not.
Right. Now,
and that's very different than divorce.
Yeah, it is. Now, just to sort of clarify that, what would be not grounds? I was going to ask you what would be some grounds for annulment, but actually it might, and we've only got a minute here till the break. Hopefully you can stay over here a little bit more, Jim. But what would be quickly some grounds not for divorce? Like, I don't like the way she made breakfast. Therefore, you know, that's not the type of thing, right? Like, this is not a no-fault annulment type deal. It's not a frivolous approach. Is that correct?
Right. You know, what happens, a valid marriage either comes into existence on the wedding day when the couple exchange vows. It comes into existence at that point, or it does not. People sometimes are mistaken when they later on see their marriages deteriorate. Maybe there's adultery involved. Maybe there's spousal abuse, these kinds of things. You know, those can be, you know, indications, of course, that there's a problem with the relationship, possibly going back even to the wedding day. But of themselves, these are not grounds for annulment. Grounds for annulment go back to the wedding day. You know, did the couple, each one, enter into the marriage freely? And that means by choice, and were they free to marry? You know, were there other impediments that made them incapable of marriage?
Right.
If they truly enter into the marriage freely and they have at least a proper understanding of what marriage is, a basic understanding, then the church is probably going to see that a valid marriage came into existence. But if something's missing, then the church could declare it null.
That's a good clarification. Jim, can you stay with us a few more minutes here? I've got a few more questions on this. All right, so we're going to go to a break. You're listening to The Don Johnson Show on Immaculate Heart Radio. We will be right back with Jim Blackburn after this short break. Stick around. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Don Johnson Show. My name's Don. Great to have you along today on Immaculate Heart Radio. If you're just joining us, I have on the line with me Jim Blackburn, who is an apologist, author, speaker. He worked for a long time running the Q&A department at Catholic Answers. He has written several wonderful books for them, including one that is part of the 20 Answers Challenge, a wonderful opportunity for you to have, I think, a more spiritually deep, educational, and uplifting Lent and Easter season. Catholic Answers is offering 20 of these 20 Answers books for half price. It's about $30, I think. And then 10 of those dollars goes to help St. Paul Street Evangelization. And they're challenging you to read all 20 of these booklets during Lent and Easter. I think it's a wonderful opportunity. Please go to Catholic.com and check it out. We have on the line, as I said, the author of three of those books, Jim Blackburn, including the one we've been focusing on, Jim, Divorce and Remarriage. Now, before the break, yes, we were talking about valid marriages and how one goes about checking out whether it can be annulled and how that's different than divorce. Let's move to another one of the hot-button issues, same-sex marriage, or so-called same-sex marriage. What's the Catholic Church's approach to that?
Yeah, and that's you're right. That's another hot-button topic these days because the homosexual community, the gay and lesbian community, want people to recognize their relationships as being the same as heterosexual relationships. And they simply are not the same. They're quite different in a number of ways, the most obvious being the fact that the couple in a heterosexual relationship are of different sexes. That's God's design for marriage, is for a man and a woman to come together and have a lifelong commitment to each other and raise a family. And these things are all important. If you understand from a Christian perspective what marriage is, and that by definition marriage is between a man and a woman, it becomes really clear that a gay union or a lesbian union, same-sex union, while you know we can call it many different things, we should not ever call it marriage, because it really detracts from the beautiful understanding of and the fullness of what marriage really is and must be about from a Christian perspective.
Yeah, it really does start with a fundamental understanding of what marriage is, doesn't it? And what the meaning of human existence is. And again, we talked about this in the first segment, but it's not so much an emphasis on being negative towards any individuals or, you know, the value of relationships and what good you can have, but just what is marriage? What's God's intention for us as people? And once you start there, it just doesn't follow, right? I mean, there's just no way to fit these same-sex unions into that.
That's right. In fact, Don, one of the fundamental requirements of marriage is that it be ordered toward procreation.
Yeah.
That means, and a lot of people don't realize this, but that means if a heterosexual couple get married and they're unable to consummate the marriage. If there's a permanent, unchangeable impediment to the couple being able to engage in intercourse, then that's actually not a marriage. The church will not recognize that as a marriage. That's how foundational the being ordered toward procreation is to marriage. Two men, two women, those relationships can never be ordered toward procreation. They simply are contrary to that. They cannot be fruitful in that way. Now, I do want to clarify, sometimes when I mention this, people will confuse the inability to consummate a marriage, which is different than sterility. Sterility is of itself not an impediment to marriage. So, for example, say an older couple who are past the age of being able to reproduce, as long as they're still able to engage in an act that is ordered toward procreation, then they can still have a marriage. So fertility itself is not required, but the ordering of the relationship towards procreation is a fundamental must of marriage.
Right. One of my things that I realized as I studied the Catholic teaching on sexual ethics and went into the whole contraception thing is that it seems to me much of the, what we would say, conservative argument against same-sex marriage was missing the contraception thing, because I think if you accept contraception, it's pretty difficult ultimately to make a really strong case against same-sex marriage, isn't it? I mean, you're missing that fundamental aspect of it, and that's one of the reasons perhaps in the culture that it has failed, that we had all these people saying, well, contraception is okay, but I'm against same-sex marriage. Well, it's actually a pretty tight logical joining there, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the Catholic Church does have a teaching on contraception, and that teaching is that it's never okay for a married couple to engage in that, because it says no to that ordering of the relationship toward procreation. It says no to that, puts an obstacle right there. But that's different. That is very different from two people who simply are not made in such a way that they can engage in a procreative act. Two men are not made to be able to do that. They're not complementary in that way.
Yeah.
Two women, the same thing. But as long as a man and woman are made that way and can consummate, and then they're not putting up that obstacle of contraception, then their conjugal act is going to be a beautiful thing.
Right. All right. Well, let's hit on one more of the hot topics. A lot of them revolve around this issue, Jim, and we mentioned it a little bit earlier, but let's dive in. Can a divorced Catholic receive communion, and what is the nature of the recent controversy over this? I know that a lot of non-Catholics just think, well, there's some in-house stuff, and we don't really know, but actually this is a pretty important deal, isn't it?
It is, and in my opinion, in my understanding, the way I interpret Amoris Laetitiae, which is the document that Pope Francis came out with after the Synod of Bishops, is that there's no change in church teaching, that there's a new pastoral approach, but not a change in church. And what is that church teaching? Well, if anyone wants to just read a basic blurb on what the church teaches in this regard, go to paragraph 1650 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Paragraph 1650 is a nice synopsis of what the church says here. And that is when, and we're not just talking about divorced Catholics, but we're talking about Catholics who are divorced and then have gone on and remarried civilly outside the church. The wedding that you know, they didn't get an annulment from their previous, for their previous marriage, and they've gone out and remarried civilly without the church's blessing. Well, the church has always recognized, again, going back to Matthew 19, verse 6, and Jesus' teaching on marriage, when a man and a woman who are married divorce and go on and marry other people, they're committing adultery. And when a Catholic does this, civilly remarries someone else, they're living in a state of perpetual sin, of perpetual adultery. And that being the case, as long as they know that and they're choosing that, they cannot receive absolution in confession, And of course, then they cannot receive the Eucharist. The thing to do in a situation like that is to either separate or stop having conjugal relations. And this is what the church recommends, and paragraph 1650 mentions this. Live in a state of marital continence, which means live as brother and sister, euphemistically. If a couple is willing to do that, you know, until the situation is resolved, if ever, then the couple can receive absolution in confession, and they can go on then to receive the Eucharist. So that, in a nutshell, is what the church teaches on this. Now, Pope Francis and the bishops have recognized that this is a widespread problem, and this is something that a lot of Catholics in this situation even feel rejected by the church, when it's really their own actions that have put them in the situation that they're in. Pope Francis wants them to know that they're still welcome in the church. The church still loves them, and it would be nice for them to have some pastoral counseling from a priest, maybe from a confessor, in order to assess their situation and hopefully get the right advice on how to proceed in their situation. And that could mean returning to the sacraments, you know, especially if we're talking about they're rectifying the situation, or they're putting themselves in a situation of brother and sister relationship until such time as the marriage can be resolved. And the church has a lot of ways of bringing that marriage, making that marriage valid when it's possible. The annulment process helps with that. There's a convalidation process that can help with that. So people need to know this. There's so many people in this situation, they need to know that the church is here to help.
Yeah.
I did, by the way, Don, there has been confusion on Chapter 8 of the Pope's document, and some bishops are interpreting it one way, some another way. I did pipe in on this myself in a blog post at Catholic Answers. Just go to catholic.com. And it's actually in the online magazine section where I address this issue. And my understanding is, no, Pope Francis isn't changing the teaching of the church. He just wants to open up this pastoral approach to help people in this situation understand their situation and remedy it.
We are talking with Jim Blackburn. He is apologist, author, speaker. His latest booklet, the one we've been talking about, is part of the 20 Answers Challenge. It's called Divorce and Remarriage. If you want more clear answers, like you have just heard for the last couple of segments, go to Catholic.com and get that. Jim, I know you've also got the booklet called Scripture and Tradition in that 20 Answers Challenge, and one on the papacy. But we have run out of time. We're going to have you come back and talk about those two. Jim, thank you so much for being here today.
Don, thank you for having me. God bless you.
All right. Thanks for being here today. Don't forget to go to DonJohnsonMinistries.org to learn more about me and catch up on all of my latest projects, including one on the sexual revolution. We'll see you next time.